Chapter 5, Joshua, May 19, 1923. Joshua knew that Bill Hillsgrove would not give up without a fight, but in the end, it all came down to money. How much was Joshua willing to part with to regain control of the launching contract? For once, he didn't care how much he had to spend. Evangeline's safety was more important than his nest egg of money. At the back of his mind, he knew that he was going to do everything he could to talk her out of her wild enterprise, but it wasn't a subject he could approach head-on. For the time being, he would simply convince her that she stood a better chance of survival if she allowed him to help her. "You saved me from drowning, lass, and now I'm going to save you. Do what I tell you, and you might, you just might, have a chance." That's what he said to her, but in his heart, he knew that she had no chance. He thought that perhaps when the boy's body finally surfaced in the whirlpool and she saw what the river had done to him, she would think again. He certainly hoped so. In the meantime, he dragged the barrel out to the center of the shed and gave it its full attention. He worked hard for 4 days, reinforcing the barrel, putting weight in the bottom, shaping a keel, before he was ready to install the padding. He knew that Cornelia Braithwaite was busy elsewhere because he began to see the results of her publicity drive. She had seized the opportunity of informing the newspapers of Evangeline's part in the attempt to rescue young Richard Steinhaus, whose body had not yet surfaced. As a result, the docks and piers at McLaren's Landing were constantly swarming with reporters. There was, they informed Joshua, so much that the public wanted to know. Was it true that Mrs. Murray had actually rescued him? If so, how? What had she said? What had she done? What about the attempt on the falls? What was he going to do to ensure her safety? He was an expert, was he not? People spoke of him as being the best on the river. That was what irritated Joshua the most. Not the questions about Evangeline, but the questions about himself. They all wanted to know about the barge. Everyone said he was a hero, a miracle worker, the one man who had dared to do what no one else would ever consider. Would he care to comment? Would he pose for a picture? The barge was still there, rusting on the riverbed. It would be great copy. "No," said Joshua. He told them he had nothing to say about the barge. He would not describe the incident, and he would not pose for them with or without the barge in the background. Unfortunately, he could exercise no control over the rest of the carnival proceedings. He couldn't even avoid being photographed alongside Mrs. Murray. He had not actually posed for the pictures, but he hadn't managed to run away in time. He hated hearing him say that he and Evangeline made a handsome pair. Beauty and the Beast was all he could think of. He knew his house guests were puzzled by his steadfast refusal to even look at the papers to see what they were saying about him. Unfortunately, Danny made up for Joshua's lack of interest by reading the articles aloud at every opportunity, even in the face of Joshua's loud protests. What he heard was that Cornelia had been lecturing to packed houses at the Victoria Park Assembly Rooms. And now there was talk of erecting bleachers on both sides of the river because huge crowds were expected. Danny added his own fervent request that he should be allowed to buy a plane because the future of the whole enterprise would depend on aerial photography. Joshua maintained a stoic refusal to comment on any of the news or on any of Danny's ideas, and he spent his waking hours working on the barrel and his nighttime hours in nightmares of rushing water and broken bodies. The nightmares were more welcome than the occasional dream he had of Evangeline herself, pathetic, lustful dreams that shamed and embarrassed him. Surely he was long over those kinds of adolescent fantasies of short red skirts and long white legs. The day came for Evangeline to be fitted into the barrel so that Joshua could build the padding around her. She came to the boathouse, accompanied by Cornelia and Iris. She shocked Joshua by wearing a pair of white, loose-fitting trousers. Occasionally, in the hell of the European battlefields, Joshua had seen a woman in pants, but not in his own boatshed. He glanced quickly away, and then looked away again. Actually, they were not unattractive, not on her. Keeping her eyes focused safely on her face, he explained to Evangeline what he had been doing to the barrel and why. He asked her to climb into the barrel and let him mark the various thicknesses of padding which would be needed. Iris and Cornelia stepped closer, with Cornelia glaring at him each time he slid his arm into the barrel alongside Evangeline. Obviously, Cornelia was convinced that Joshua was intent on committing some indecency on Evangeline's person. "I've been a widower for 20 years," he wanted to say. "I know how to control myself." But he didn't say it, because it wasn't true. Around Evangeline Murray, he had great difficulty in controlling himself. He thrust aside his lustful thoughts and continued to make marks on the inside of the barrel, where Evangeline crouched with her knees up to her chin and her head tucked down into her arms. "All right," he said eventually. "You can come out now, lass." He extended a hand to help her, but Cornelia was ahead of him, protecting her investment and extending her own hand. "What will you be wearing?" Joshua asked. "What business is that of yours?" Cornelia asked. "Everything that happens inside and outside of this barrel is my business now," he snapped. "What will Mrs. Murray be wearing?" "My bathing dress," Evangeline responded. He shook his head. "No, no, that will never do." "Several suits of long underwear. That would be the thing, protecting the joints." "Oh, I don't think so, Mr. McLaren," Evangeline argued. "You see, there are publicity pictures to think of. Posing with the barrel, climbing into the barrel, being pulled out of the barrel, I sincerely hope. I couldn't be wearing several suits of long underwear. And besides, I don't know where I could get long underwear this time of year."
"I could lend you my spare set," Joshua said. The words were out of his mouth before he realized how foolish he sounded.
Evangeline was gravely polite, although there was a smile lurking behind her solemn expression, just waiting to burst forth. "That's most kind of you, Mr. McLaren, but I don't think it would look right."
"Aye, well, if it's vanity you're concerned with."
"No, no," she was smiling. "I mean, you lending me your underwear. After all, I barely know you."
"Aye, well, suit yourself."
She was still smiling at him. "I didn't mean to offend you," she said. The smile vanished. "You think I'm a fool, don't you? A vain, conceited fool." He wanted to take her hand and tell her that she was the bravest, fiercest, loveliest woman he'd ever met. But he was long out of practice at saying such things. Instead, he said simply, "It's none of my business."
"Quite right," said Cornelia Braithwaite, pushing between them. "None of your business at all. Mrs. Murray will wear her bathing suit, and that's all there is to it. The key to a satisfactory outcome is the right publicity. I know that we women invite lewd advances when we wear..."
She was interrupted by Iris DeVere, who tapped her arm and said, "Do you really think so, Cornelia? After all, it is a very modest bathing dress."
"Of course I think so," Cornelia replied. "If I didn't think so, I wouldn't have said so. Mrs. Murray will wear the bathing dress. There'll be no more discussion on the subject."
Such was the force of the famous Miss Braithwaite that Joshua found himself nodding his agreement. Mrs. Murray would wear her bathing suit. No doubt about it. And lewd advances would be dealt with as and when they occurred.
"Time for a lunch," announced Cornelia.
"Really?" Evangeline looked surprised.
"Most certainly. A regular eating schedule is important to a healthy body, and a healthy body is essential to our cause. Lunch, Mrs. Murray."
"I'm not really hungry," Evangeline protested.
"Oh, very well, suit yourself. I don't suppose it will make any difference now," said Cornelia. "Come along, Iris."
Iris glanced from Evangeline to Cornelia and then back again. "I'm not really hungry either."
"Iris!"
It was a command, and Iris obeyed, clutching her purse to her inadequate bosom and scuttling out of the boat shed behind Cornelia. Joshua found himself alone with Evangeline.
"Mr. McLaren," Evangeline said hesitantly, "if I could just explain my motives to you."
Joshua thought that the air in the boat shed had suddenly become stiflingly hot. He could hardly breathe.
"None of my business," he managed to say, and he leaned over the barrel, studying his pencil marks and refusing to look up.
He didn't trust himself to speak. There was so much he wanted to say, but all that ever came out of his mouth was surly disapproval.
"You see, Mr. McLaren, I'm a widow, and...
She's a widow, sang a little voice in Joshua's head. I knew that. I knew that. Thank God she's a widow.
And I have enormous debts, Evangeline continued.
You need more weight in the keel, Joshua muttered.
My husband died suddenly last year, and he had never been one for managing his money.
Joshua made a meaningless pencil mark on the rim of the barrel.
What sort of man had John Murray been, he asked himself, that he could leave his widow with this kind of burden?
You see, he said aloud, as though Evangeline had not spoken at all, you need enough weight in the keel to make the barrel float upright in the current and stop you from going topsy-turvy.
There was no distracting Evangeline. She seemed determined to explain herself to him.
Of course, my sons are almost grown up now, but they still rely on me, and I couldn't think of any other way of making a great deal of money in a very short period of time.
Let them make their own money, Joshua grouched.
She laughed bitterly, with no joy.
They don't seem to be very good at that. I think they take after their father.
You wouldn't believe the trouble they get into.
I'm desperate, Mr. McLaren.
Desperate to kill yourself?
But I might succeed. Others have.
He looked her straight in the eye.
Aye, you might succeed, he conceded reluctantly. If you listen to what I'm telling you now.
How are you planning to breathe?
The amusement, which always seemed to be just below the surface of her features, bubbled up into laughter.
Oh, in and out. Through my nose.
This is no laughing matter, Joshua protested.
Yes, it is. She laughed again with an edge of hysteria. It's hilarious. Don't you see how funny this is? Evangeline Murray, respectable widowed mother of two, posing for the photographer in a borrowed suit of underwear.
I was serious about that, Joshua said. It will help protect your joints.
I know, she patted his arm, still laughing. But it's all so silly. If you had told me 2 months ago that I would be preparing to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel, I would have told you to...
Well, you know.
It's all so improbable. I don't do this sort of thing. It's really very funny. She sat down abruptly on a packing case. Tears of laughter were streaming down her face. The laughter grew desperate and painful to watch, but Joshua was powerless to help her. All he could do was say disapprovingly, Really, Mrs. Murray? And that ridiculous-looking barrel, she said, pointing. Not to mention that silly old lesbian.
What?
He felt his face turning red.
Had she just said what he thought she said?
Of course, he'd heard the word before. 4 years in the trenches, and there were very few words that a man hadn't heard. But to hear her say it? That was a very different matter.
Miss Braithwaite, Evangeline said by way of clarification.
Mrs. Murray, he muttered, feeling the heat rise in his face.
It's the plain truth, Evangeline said. Surely you realize that.
I didn't give it much thought, Joshua replied, wishing the floor would open up and swallow him.
Evangeline looked up at him through her long eyelashes.
Why, Mr. McLaren, I do believe you're blushing.
I just thought that you, being a man of the world...
I'm not a man of the world, Joshua replied. But I'd like to think of myself as a gentleman, and I have never had such a conversation as this with a lady.
Oh, dear, said Evangeline.
I'm sorry. I really am.
She was smiling at him again.
I was quite a lady once upon a time, but my husband kept some very bad company, and I kept it right along with him. Sometimes I forget that there are still gentlemen in the world.
I apologize.
No need to apologize, said Joshua. He looked at her again and smiled.
My nephew tells me I'm narrow-minded.
She nodded encouragingly, as though expecting him to say more.
I must admit that I wondered, he said. Anyway, she's one of the most unattractive women I've ever met.
Ah, said Evangeline, so you do look at attractive women.
I was beginning to wonder.
Of course I do.
I'm well aware that you're an attractive woman, Mrs. Murray, Joshua said. They stared at each other, their eyes meeting and holding, and he wondered what he should say next. Was this the moment? Yes, surely it was.
Mrs. Bury, Evangeline, he said, I really don't want you to do this.
You don't want me to do it? She said fiercely. You don't want me to do it. Since when has it been up to you what I do?
No, no, he stuttered. I didn't mean it that way.
Then what do you mean?
Do you think that just because you're a man...
Yes, he said.
I'm a man and you're a woman, and all I want is to...
Suddenly the door was flung open. Daylight flooded the intimate darkness, and Danny told them breathlessly that Richard Steinhaus had surfaced in the whirlpool.
Danny.
Danny had not minded when his uncle told him that his responsibility for the next couple of days would be to watch the whirlpool and wait for the body to surface. Sitting on the riverbank in the spring sunshine was preferable to toiling in the boat shed under Joshua McLaren's grim and disapproving eyes. Because it always took a couple of days for a body to fight its way to the surface, Danny watched alone for the first 48 hours. He tried not to think about the dead kid's body, driven deep down by the force of the falls and scraping along the bed of the Niagara River, tossed and turned by fierce currents and battered by rocks until it was lifted by the current into the maelstrom of the whirlpool. Mattie Ferguson, who had nothing better to do, joined him on the third day. Sergeant Renfrew of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police looked in on them every now and then. The boys' family waited at their home upriver. Danny and Mattie perched at the top of the cliff where the Niagara took a 90-degree turn and created a huge circular basin surrounded by small pebble beaches and flat outcroppings of rock. The water along the shoreline was deceptively calm, but in the center of the basin the river circled endlessly and fiercely. Mattie had dozed off in the afternoon sun, and Danny had to kick him awake to show him what he'd seen. Danny knew that he would be severely castigated if he went galloping off to his uncle with a false alarm, but there was definitely something down there, in the center of the whirlpool, where everything came to the surface. Mattie shuffled to the edge and looked down into the basin.
Yes, he said eventually, it's a floater.
Do you reckon it's him? Danny asked. The kid from Chippewa?
Could be, Mattie said. It don't matter much. Whoever it is, they got to be pulled out of there. Can't leave them like that.
No, of course not, but it has to be him. There hasn't been anyone else.
Not that we know about, Mattie corrected him.
Someone else could have jumped, I suppose. They do it all the time, blamed fools.
There's nothing in this world worth killing yourself over.
Not now.
He coughed and spat a few times and continued staring at the dark shape trapped in the water among the tangle of tree limbs and refuse.
Go on, lad. Go get your uncle.
And get someone to telephone Sergeant Renfrew. He'll want to know about this.
Danny pulled his bicycle from out of the weeds and set off down the hill to McLaren Landing at a great pace. He didn't bother with the brakes until he had practically collided with the door of the boat shed. Something was going on in the gloomy interior. Evangeline Murray looked as though she'd been crying, and Uncle Joshua was red in the face with anger. Danny sighed to himself. Why did his uncle keep bullying that poor woman? Why not let her go ahead and do what she wanted to do? That's what life was all about, doing what you wanted to do.
He surfaced, Danny announced.
Joshua pulled his pipe out of his pocket and slowly filled and lit it before he said anything. The shed was filled with a dense, dusty silence, as though there were words to speak, but they had not been spoken and would never be spoken. Joshua was calm and practical.
Go to the house, he said, and tell your aunt to phone Sergeant Renfrew, and then go and get the car out.
Yes, said Danny. Can I?
No, you can't, said Joshua.
I was going to say, can I help you?
Oh, I thought you wanted to drive.
Yes, lad, you can help me.
Joshua turned to Evangeline Murray. You'd best come with us, he said abruptly, and see what the river does to a body. Danny admired the way that Evangeline looked at his uncle in the eye. She wasn't a bit scared of the old devil. She was smiling at him.
I'll look, she said, but it won't stop me. My reasons haven't changed. I have to do this.
Danny saw his uncle stretch a tentative hand towards Evangeline as though to comfort her, but she was already on her feet, pushing past Danny into the fresh air and away from whatever it was that clouded the atmosphere in the boathouse.
Joshua parked the car at the clifftop where Matty Ferguson sat waiting, along with some other local men. Danny and Joshua unloaded the rope and tackle. The men followed a path of sorts where the cliffs were at their lowest. Halfway down the hillside, on a rocky ledge, they stopped to collect the boat that was kept there for this very purpose. It was a sturdy wooden craft, lashed down above the winter ice level. It had been safe there for many years. No local person was likely to take it. They all knew what it was for. Joshua scrambled ahead of them, issuing orders while Danny held back to help Evangeline down the cliff face. He was impressed by her agility. She descended quite as nimbly as Joshua, and a good deal more quickly than Matty. The men untied the boat and lowered it the rest of the way down the cliff by means of the rope and tackle that Joshua had brought from the boatyard. But now there were some half-dozen men waiting to help launch the boat into the water. "Is it safe to go out there?" Evangeline asked. It was the first time she'd spoken since they left the boathouse. Joshua looked up from fitting the oars into the rowlocks. "It is if you know what you're doing," he said. "Can I come?" Danny asked. His uncle looked at him doubtfully. "He was just a kid," Danny said. "I want to help." "If anything happens to you, your aunt will never forgive me," Joshua argued. "I'll be fine," Danny said. "You won't let anything happen to me." Behind him, he heard Evangeline give a little gasp, but then he was leaping forward, scrambling for a seat in the boat as his uncle grunted his approval. The men at the oars kept the boat in the calm water at the edge of the pool for as long as possible. And then Joshua chose his spot. "Get the boat hook, boy," he said to Danny, as the men struck out into the current, pulling strongly on the oars. Danny leaped from the bow, refusing to admit his terror as the small boat was caught by the current and began to circle towards the middle. They were headed straight for the tangled branches and the dark object at their outer edge. Danny looked up at the cliffs and saw that a crowd had gathered to watch. The little boat bucked against the current, and his terror left him replaced by a determination to do a good job. They drew closer. Danny reached out with a boat hook. There was no clothing to grab onto. The body was completely naked, but it was definitely a kid about his own age. Fortunately, the corpse was not putrefied, having been preserved by the cold water. The boat hook caught in the branches, and Danny pulled the whole mass towards the boat. The boat rocked precariously as another of the men fastened a rope around one pale blue ankle. "Okay," he shouted, "we've got him." The men leaned into the oars and began to pull powerfully and smoothly back towards the shore. They made it look easy, but Danny knew that this was a job for experienced rivermen. "How many is that?" Danny asked. Joshua shook his head. "I don't know. I gave up counting after the first 100. Ask any of the men here. They've all given up counting. It's just too many." As soon as the bow of the boat scraped ashore on the rocky beach, Sergeant Renfrew came forward to help them pull in their catch. "It's not too messy," Joshua said. Renfrew glanced at the boy and disagreed with Joshua. "He looks pretty well cut up. He must have gone deep." "Could have been caught between a couple of rocks," Joshua suggested. "That'll mess him up every time." He pulled his pipe out of his pocket and the police sergeant offered a pouch of tobacco. Danny flipped a dog-eared cigarette from behind his ear, feeling that he had earned the right to stand close to the adult men. All of the men puffed companionably, showing no emotion as they stood over the body. It was Richard Steinhaus, no doubt about that. The young face was hideous in its death mask. And the body, what was left of it, was hacked and cut as though the boy had been the victim of some demented attacker. Danny realized why the men on the boat had only roped one ankle. Only one ankle remained. "Poor child," said a voice in Danny's ear. He was surprised to find that Evangeline Murray was standing beside him. He had expected that she would be long gone. "How can you look at him like that?" It was Matty Ferguson who answered her. "You get used to it," he said. "Surely not," Evangeline argued. Matty shook his head. "Not this death in particular," he said, "but death in general. We all had 4 years of it in Europe. Hell with the lid off, that's what it was. This kid had a peaceful death, if you ask me." "Couldn't you at least cover him with a blanket?" Evangeline said.
Can you not bear to look at him? Joshua asked.
You should look, very carefully. This is what happens to you in the river. You don't get turned into a rainbow and sent to live with the gods. This is where you go.
Danny was surprised at the anger in Evangeline's face when she looked at her uncle.
I know a lot about drowning, she said. My husband drowned. I've no doubt he ended up looking like this. But I would like to hope that if he was pulled ashore, someone would show some respect for his body.
This is someone's child. He has a family. Is this what you want for your child?
My child didn't even get this much respect, Joshua snapped back.
Oh, said Evangeline, I'm sorry. I didn't know.
Joshua looked away at the distance for a moment, and then he turned back and said, You're right, Mrs. Murray. The young fool deserves better than this.
The men wrapped Richard Steinhouse in a gray blanket and hauled him up the cliff face to wait for the hearse. Then they pulled the boat up to the ledge and tied down the oars.
Evangeline watched, saying nothing, her face very white.
I've informed the coroner and the next of kin. They'll be along shortly, said Sergeant Renfrew.
You should stay and meet them, Joshua. And you too, Mrs. Murray. They're grateful for what you did to try to save him.
Joshua shook his head. I have work to do. Mrs. Murray can stay if she wants. She likes publicity.
Danny saw the flush on Evangeline's face, anger building at his uncle's intolerable rudeness.
What on earth was the matter with that man? Why must he be needling her all the time?
This is not the kind of publicity I'm looking for, and you know it, she said.
Ah, yes, said the sergeant, the barrel.
We've all heard about that.
Let me ask you, do you have all of your permits? I haven't seen anything in writing.
Evangeline looked at him blankly.
Permits?
Mattie issued one of his wheezing, painful laughs. Now why didn't Miss Cornelia Bossy Boots Braithwaite think of that, eh?
The officer's right. You can't launch without a permit, miss, and they're not easy to get at short notice.
Why didn't you tell me? Evangeline asked Joshua.
It's not my job to tell you, Joshua replied.
Danny thought he looked secretly pleased.
Hillsgrove should have told you. I think you've left it too late.
Evangeline tossed her head in defiance.
We'll see about that, she said, and walked away to sit in the car.
Tough little madam, isn't she? Said Renfrew.
Oh, I think she's great, Danny said. Don't you, Uncle?
No, I don't, said Joshua. I think she's a fool who shouldn't be allowed out on her own, and I think we better get her home, in a hurry.
She's sitting in my car turning a pale shade of green.
She's not nearly as tough as she'd like to have you think.
Wait here with the sergeant boy. I'll take her home.
Danny watched his uncle's retreating back.
I swear, he said to Mattie, that man doesn't have an ounce of romance in his soul.
Oh, he has more than you think, Mattie replied. I think that's his problem.